History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We also realize that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions. As I mention that each week, I know that so many of you are doing just that with the veterans in your life. One question leads to another, and if we're patient enough to listen, we're going to end up hearing things that add quite a bit to our perspective. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we really do become inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend, our focus turns to Independence Day and birthday number 247 for this noble experiment we call the United States of America. In signing the Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776, our founders pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to a vision of freedom and liberty that continues to call out to us today. Did you know that 9 of the 56 men who signed that courageous document lost their lives in the War for Independence? And every conflict our country has engaged in since has added to that number. Hometown Heroes has focused primarily on the World War II generation. That was an era in which more Americans served in our armed forces than in any other period. And as we prepare for another Independence Day, today's program will frame that up through the views and experiences of three different distinguished World War II veterans whose perspectives on America and on freedom were colored by their experiences during that time. One of them came to value his freedom as an American even more greatly after nearly dying in captivity as a prisoner of war. Another saw the ideals and promise of America change his life as an immigrant who arrived with nothing but became one of our most highly decorated aerial aces. And the man whose memories we're going to hear first had to persevere through a trying and confusing time when his very status as a natural-born citizen and the rights that come with it were canceled because of his ethnic heritage. The late Sam Terasaki, a highly respected pharmacist in the Denver, Colorado area, was one of approximately 33,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry who served in our armed forces in World War II. He would have gone overseas much earlier in the war if he hadn't, like so many other Nisei veterans you've heard from on Hometown Heroes over the years, been classified as 4C, enemy alien, in the wake of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Eventually, Sam deployed in a mortar squad with the 100th Battalion, by then folded into the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. He saw all of 1 month of combat in Europe, but not only did he survive some very close calls, that experience would shape so much of the rest of his life and his perspective on America.
Well, the foxhole was dug in a position where there was a huge rock on our left side, up against a huge rock. A rifle grenade or potato masher, I think it was a rifle grenade, came down and luckily hit on the opposite side of that rock.
So bang. Only a few feet from you, maybe 10 feet or something?
No, inches.
But the rock was in between you and the impact.
Yeah.
So if the rock's not there,
we're gone. We're gone. One of the, I don't know whether he was an officer or not, but he was in the outfit that was there before we replaced them, came down the trail. It was a narrow, very narrow trail. He's kind of chuckling. I think he was happy that he's going to go to the rear echelon. He says, those guys are up there throwing grenades at each other. Well, that's what happened. In fact, the one Medal of Honor that was bestowed during the war was Spud Munimori, who was in our company, A Company. In fact, I'd just talked to him an hour before when the rifle platoon was cutting through our line to get ahead of us, and I just happened to see him, and I said, okay, well, take it easy, Spud. It was still dark, and that was the last I saw him. He was killed, saving the life of two of his squad members by jumping on the grenade before it exploded. Took his own life, saved their lives.
I can tell in your eyes and in your voice that he's someone you admire and respect.
Absolutely. And it's something that I never talked about for maybe 50 years after the fact, I guess. I don't know how many years it was, but I just couldn't talk about it without crying. It was my family. We had a dinner at home, and I don't know how the subject came up, but I started crying. I guess somebody wanted to know about the war, and I had to excuse myself. And I find the more you talk about it, the easier it is to do it without getting so emotional. But some things that, horrible things that, you know, we had, I think, five guys in our company alone that had their foot blown off that morning. It was the 5th of April.
Your first day in combat.
Yeah, and they had their foot blown off, and the litter bearers, like I say, the trail up to the front lines was so narrow that they had to come by our gun emplacement. Artillery, you could hear it coming. Mortar rounds, you didn't hear it until it was just before it exploded. You hear a squish, and it's shh, bang. Whereas German 88, you'd hear shoo, and then it would explode.
So how close did German mortar rounds come to your position?
We were leaving a fort in North Italy, spent the night in the fort, old, old fort, ancient fort that had a moat around it, bars on the windows. When we left there, we were shelled that night, but the artillery shells hit the wall, so all it did is kind of knock the breath out of us, but it didn't penetrate the walls because they were so thick. But when we pushed out of there, we followed this stone wall that bordered the roadside. Just then a mortar attack happened. Turns out that one of our jeeps was just coming back, and I think he must have been a forward observer or something from ahead of us. For some reason, he stopped there. There was a wall in between us and where the jeep was and where we were resting, and mortar shells came down. Next thing you know, the guy's laying on the ground. One of our guys is laying on the ground on the road, hollering, "Medics, medics." So I think it was Mike and myself jumped over the wall and went over there and put a bandage on his calf. He was had a bad slash, a shrapnel slash on his calf. We all carried this first aid thing. It's a pad, and we put it on there and then tie it as tight as you can. Compress is what it was. That's closest I came to a mortar attack, I think. On the 5th of April, I don't think we were exposed to as many mortar attacks as we were to artillery and to grenades, rifle grenades.
And you told us about the one, the grenade that landed on the other side of the rock.
Yeah.
Were there other situations that you look back on now and say, hey, that was pretty close?
Oh, I guess in one town, as we pushed forward in Italy, in one town, we were getting shelled. Fortunately, one of the shells didn't hit us, but hit the house down the road from us. And I think it was some B Company guys got killed then. I jumped in a haystack. The Italian farmhouses had their animals on the first floor and their living quarters on the second floor. This is on the first floor. Jumped in the haystack, not realizing the place was full of fleas. I fought the fleas for the next 2 months.
Regretted that decision?
Well, I itched a lot, scratched a lot.
I guess it would be worth it if being in the haystack saved your life.
That's right. And it just so happened that the guy that was driving the truck full of artillery shells or whatever it was parked the car and ran into the house. And here's this truck loaded with ammunition. And of course, the Germans didn't hit it. Been one hell of an explosion. I don't know what the name of the town. You know, as a infantryman or mortarman, you don't get the latest news. In fact, some of the old-timers knew that the war was going to end then. We never knew that.
When did you figure it out, and what did it mean to you?
Didn't believe it. We were in a town in northern Italy after we had captured a number of Germans and had them on the run. I was in a town, spent a miserable night in this town square, rained all night, covered myself with my shelter half, and woke up in the morning and all kinds of native Italians running around said the war is over. I didn't believe them, but it was shortly after that an observation plane flew over and dumped the bundles of the Stars and Stripes and said the war is over. That's when I knew.
How big of a relief was that?
Oh, you don't. I remember none of the guys jump up and down or anything. It just kind of took it as a matter of fact. We were happy that it was over, and it was a day or two later we had a memorial service at an abandoned warehouse. Our chaplain delivered a sermon and read the names of all the guys in the 100th that, from the first one that was killed in, down in Salerno. Very sad. Couldn't help from crying.
I believe it. And I'm sure, even though, as you're telling it, there was only about a month that you spent in real intense combat, that had to be the longest month of your life, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And there had to be days in there where you thought your name could have been one of those that chaplain's reading.
Well, maybe wondered why I'd survived and the others didn't.
Did you have days where you thought that was going to be it? Did you?
Oh, sure, yeah. Pray to God when we're under artillery fire that the next one wouldn't come over and hit us.
It's got to be a pretty helpless feeling.
It is. What do? Put your hands over your head and hug the ground as much as you can and hope that you don't get hit. I know I recited the Lord's Prayer all the time.
I'm just imagining being in those shoes and how lonely and scary and just difficult that must have been.
It was. It was scary. When your legs start shaking, you can't stop it from shaking. That's when I knew I was scared.
And you mentioned that memorial service while you're still there in Italy and the war has just ended and they're reading off name after Japanese surname. Some of those guys are probably guys you knew.
Yeah.
And you told them, you're crying.
Yeah.
How should we today remember those guys whose names you heard read that day?
Well, I don't know. I just live a good life. Pay them back by living a good life and being tolerant. You know, when I joined the outfit, from the old-timers, I heard maybe three or four names of guys that they all looked up to. One of them, who was our chaplain, Israel Yost, Pennsylvania Dutch chaplain that never knew what an American of Japanese ancestry was. In fact, he was given the option of not being in the 100th Battalion if he didn't want to be. I told him that this is made up of all Japanese Americans, and you don't have to be part of it if you don't want to. And he says, no, it makes no difference to him. He wanted to be a combat chaplain, and that's what he did. So he was one of the guys that all of the old-timers used to talk about, because he wasn't a chaplain that stayed in the back. He was a chaplain that was right up there with the medics, retrieving bodies, giving the last rites, things like that. Two more. Fukuda ended up as battalion commander in the end. Didn't have to lead the Fukuda Task Force, which was actually just, I think, one or two jeeps going from the last place in northern Italy that we went to. They drove all the way up to the Swiss border. He very well could have been shot by a sniper or something. A Korean-American who was our battalion intelligence officer. They were aware of the friction between Koreans and Japan.
Yeah.
So they gave him also the option. Of course, he says, I grew up in Los Angeles. My father had a grocery store there. I have a lot of Japanese-American friends. That makes no difference to me. He gained a lot of respect. When the 100th Battalion was Anzio, they needed information. He crawled on his belly and took two non-coms with him. He crawled on his belly all night and grabbed a couple of German prisoners and made them crawl all the way back, and they got information.
Sounds like those guys set a pretty powerful example.
He did.
Were you excited to come home?
Oh, absolutely. Even though it was a slow ship, I went over on the Queen Mary, which was a fast ship.
Yeah.
Came home on a Victory ship, which was a slow ship. But we were bringing home the regimental colors in the summertime, sleep on the deck at night, ice cream every night.
Hey, hey.
Movies. Well, we hit New York Harbor because it was a big celebration that the city of New York and the Army put on for us, welcoming the regiment home. Big to-do in New York Harbor and then preparing to march in Washington, D.C.
What was that like?
I think we drilled for almost 2 weeks at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, across the Potomac from D.C., got new uniforms and everything. And then I went over to D.C. and it was a rainy day, but the story goes that asked Truman, he said, in light of the weather, you want to cancel, and he says, no. He supposedly said, what these boys been through, what's a little rain? So He came out of the White House to the Ellipse, which is a oval-shaped area across from the White House, and we passed in review, and he had a rain trench coat on and pinned the presidential unit citation on our regimental colors and welcomed us home.
quite the contrast from being told you're 4C.
Well, it is. Thinking back makes you wonder. Roosevelt, I don't think, really knew the character of the Americans of Japanese ancestry that lived in this country. He was born and raised in New York, and I don't think there are very many Japanese back there.
I've noticed a few times now that every time you refer to it, you use the verbiage, Americans of Japanese ancestry. You don't want a hyphen in there anywhere.
No.
Why is that?
I've been approached by a number of people, and because of my facial features and stuff, they say, are you Japanese? I know what they mean.
Right.
But I make it a point to say, no, I'm an American. Not to embarrass them, but what they have to realize is that America is made up of all different ethnic groups. And I'm an American, I just happen to be an American of Japanese ancestry.
And when you are in front of the White House with the President of the United States pinning the highest honor he can give to a unit on your unit colors, I guess you guys proved how American you were.
Never occurred to me.
And you said something to me. You'd be eligible for a Bronze Star for having been a combat soldier in Europe. You'd be eligible for a medal from the French government for helping to liberate that country. And you have not taken advantage of those opportunities. And you told me that the things that mean the most to you are that PUC, that Presidential Unit Citation, and your Combat Infantry Badge. Why? Why do those two decorations give you pride?
I've seen too many guys who deserve more than they got. One of the things that when I went over and we're in our off times, we'd talk about it, and you know, the guys would say, well, you know, so-and-so should have gotten a Medal of Honor. He didn't. He got a Distinguished Service Cross instead. And it said, all in how you write it up. And apparently, our higher-ups didn't know how to exactly write up a citation. That was part of it, and probably a lesser part than the fact that they weren't about to give a Congressional Medal of Honor to. There was even controversy about giving a Congressional Medal of Honor to Munimori.
Well, and the thing that backs that up is what President Clinton did in the 90s,
yeah,
which was upgrade some of those Distinguished Service Crosses to Medals of Honor for guys like your friend
that's
Joe Sakato here in Denver.
So I told my son and my family, they, why didn't you apply for those? Medals don't mean that much to me.
I do want to ask you about one other medal, though. 60 years after the war, they say the Congressional Gold Medal goes to all Nisei veterans.
And my son, I wasn't even going to go to that, but my family insisted I go, and they said, well, you need an escort. I said, I could do it myself. My son said, oh, I'd like to go anyway. So we went, and we were there for the ceremony.
What did that mean to you, that the Congress of the United States is singling you out as saying you did something worth celebrating?
It meant a lot to me that we were getting the recognition that we deserved. On the other hand, we're sitting back there several rows back, and the politicians are sitting in front of us. And I told my son, I said, where were they when we needed them? But it was good because Danny Noe gave a nice speech.
I was going to say, he's the one politician you couldn't blame because he's a Medal of Honor winner.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to forget to say something important. Thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story from your perspective. When it comes to the Americans of Japanese ancestry who served our country during World War II, what gives you the most pride, and what do you think is the biggest thing that the rest of us who weren't around then need to know and remember?
I'm glad I served. My feeling is it opened the doors for the rest of our children. They're doing things that we wouldn't even think of doing, no. So it's life is easier, even though I know that they face discrimination once in a while. So I think we opened a lot of doors. That was because the Nisei soldiers did a good job. The guys in the MIS did a good job. The other thing is I want to make sure that this story is told over and over again. Something like the Jewish Holocaust. If you don't talk about it, they're going to forget.
And it could happen again.
It could happen again. The fact that I let you interview me and the fact that I've been interviewed before, and it's because I want the rest of the America to know what we did during the war, that we're Americans just like anyone else that was born here, even though we look different.
The late Sam Terasaki from the 100th Battalion and the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. It's time for our first break on this Independence Day special. When we come back, he came here from Greece, not knowing if he'd even make it across the Atlantic, and he became a legendary ace with an unwavering passion for what America represents. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in honor of Independence Day, triangulating three World War II veterans' memories into a picture of what America represents and why that freedom idealized by our founders 247 years ago is still relevant today. Steve Pisano's passed away in 2016, but if you pick up his book, The Flying Greek, the ace pilot's passion for America jumps off the page. He grew up in Athens, and as it turns out, his path to the cockpit started on the high seas.
I fell in love with the Western cowboys. Mm-hmm. I used to go to the movies and see nothing but cowboys. Tom Mix, Buck Jones, Ken Maynard. I wanted to really immediately go to America, but I had no way, no money. I couldn't speak English. So one of my friends, whose son had been with the Greek merchant marine. He says, you join the merchant marine, and someday, Greek ship, you know, is bound to dock in an American port. That's where you just get away from the ship and stay in America. In America, you can do the impossible.
So is that how it happened?
Yeah. So I got a job on a merchant ship, and we went down to South America, then we came back to Greece, and then we went out again, and we came to Baltimore, Maryland. And it was then when I jumped ship.
And how old were you?
I was about 19, 20.
You're 19, 20 years old.
Yeah.
Your family's all back in Greece.
All in Greece, yeah.
Did they know you were plotting this?
Oh, no, they had no idea.
You just jumped ship? With nothing. I mean, you've got nothing,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. But one of the guys on the ship there, you know, he says, you don't want to become a merchant marine slave. He says, once we get to Baltimore, he said, get away and go to New York. Mm-hmm. You're bound to find some Greeks there. You know, they got a lot of restaurants and so on. And that's exactly what I did.
Could you speak English yet or no?
Not at all. Not at all. Few words.
You jump off a ship in Baltimore. You've got really nothing going for you. No money, no clothes, nothing.
Correct. I had about $5 with me.
And you can't even speak the language.
Exactly.
What in the world were you thinking?
So anyway, I got to New York there and I began to walk. I came out on 34th Street and 8th Avenue. Then I looked across the avenue there and I saw the Greek and the American flag. Oh, my God, I said, the Greek flag there. Something. There must be some Greeks. So I crossed the avenue, and it was at a movie house playing The Shepherd's Daughter, the first movie ever made in Greece. Oh, my God, I've seen that in Athens, and all of a sudden, two Greek fellows, you know, stopped behind me, and one of them in Greek, saying in Greek, you know, says, what do the Greeks know about making movies? Movies are made in Hollywood. So the other guy said, let's go in and see it, and, you know, if we don't like it, we can always walk out. Then it was then when I intervened and I said, excuse me, I said, what is it you want to know about this movie? You know, I saw this movie in Athens. In Athens? And what are you doing here? I told him what I had done. And he said, where are you going? I don't know. I said, I hope, you know, I find it to park and sleep for the night until I find. No, he says, you know, this is my brother. They introduce themselves. He says, you come with us. We live in Brooklyn. And that's how I really saved my leg coming to America.
That's an incredible story in its own right. And you talk about Hollywood and the movies. And I hope your story ends up on the big screen someday. I know the book, The Flying Greek, has made many people contemplate that. And Telly Savalas was going to work on that
Oh, yeah, Telly. Here says, we got to make a movie. And, of course, you know, the guy passed away. But Tom Hanks has a copy of the book also, too. Uh-huh. And I met Tom Hanks, you know. He says, my God, he says, what a story.
You think he could play you?
It's hard to tell.
I don't know if anyone would believe this story, though. That's the hard part. So how do you go from that, without a place to stay in New York, randomly meeting people after you see the Greek flag, to becoming a fighter pilot in World War II?
Once I got established, I got a job on a restaurant. I stayed with these people there for a while. I moved, and I was close to a working place. And then one of my friends there on our day off, he says, you want to really learn how to fly? I said, yeah, I'd like to. But he says, let's go down to Floyd Bennett Field. I'll show you. He took me to Floyd Bennett Field. He introduced me to a guy up there who had two small airplanes, and that's how I began to learn to fly. About a couple of years later, I had accumulated close to 100 hours. I got my private pilot's license. I was able to really learn English and pass the exam. It was then about the war in Europe, of course, had begun, and when one of my friends, you know, I said, all the Italians, you know, invaded Greece, and God done it, if I can really get there. He said, you really want to get to the fight? I said, yeah, but I tried to join the army. They wouldn't take me because I was not an American. He said, how would you like to join the Royal Air Force? I said, what? He said, the Royal Air Force is here in America and recruiting American pilots. You have a license? He says, I tell you, he says, you go to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. On the third floor, there is an office, Clayton Knight Committee. Walk in and tell them who you are, show the license, and tell them what you want to do. On my day off, I caught the train. I went to New York and found the hotel. And I walked into this office, you know, and I introduced myself. And they took my name and everything. He says, we'll notify you. About a month or so later, I got a telephone call. He said, you have been accepted to join the Royal Air Force. And he said, we have made arrangements for you to attend Polaris Flight Academy in Glendale, California. But I had a problem. I was working at the Park Hotel at this time in Plainfield, New Jersey. How do I tell my Park Hotel owner, German fellow, who had come to Germany the same way I did, and he had really become a millionaire? How do I tell him, you know, that I'm going to leave the hotel because I had joined the Royal Air Force? And one day I said to myself, I got to do it. I got to tell him. So I walked into his office and I said, Mr. Stender, I got to tell you something. Well, what is it, Steve? He said, you want another pay? He had given me a couple pay raises. No. I said, Mr. Stender, I told him, you know, what I had done. I thought he was going to get up and punch me in the face. He got up and he came around and, you know, put his hand around my shoulder, you know, and said, Steve, he says, I admire you for what you have done. He said, and I wish you good luck. And all the time I was overseas with the RAF, you know, and he sent me packages with goodies and everything. And he said, when the war is over, I want you back in the hotel. And, of course, then I drifted because I decided to stay at the Air Force and so on.
Well, you talk about care packages from him. I'm curious about your family. Did you ever have contact with your family, and how did they react to what you had done?
After the war.
But this whole time during the war, nothing?
I couldn't really get in touch with them.
So they don't know what's happened to you. You took a ship and they never saw you again.
Exactly.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
We'll come back around to that. So you come out here to California to train, and this is before Pearl Harbor, right?
Yeah, correct, yeah.
Because America's not in the war, but the British are, and you want to fly for somebody because your homeland's been invaded.
Correct.
So you become a fighter pilot with the RAF. What did you fly with the Royal Air Force?
I started to fly Hurricanes, and then I switched over to Spitfires.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, I was with the 71 Eagle Squadron. Later on, you know, when America came in, the American Eagle Squadrons were transferred to the 4th Fighter Group.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the 4th Fighter Group ended up the war with 1,016 victories.
Ooh.
Unbelievable. Number one outfit in the U.S. Air Force. FW-190s, enemy 109s. I sat down 10 of them. Mm-hmm. Six FW-190s and four enemy 109s. And funny, you know, years later, after the war, I met Adolf Galland, a German great guy, you know. And so he was asking me, and you sat down, Amy? Oh, I said, yes, General. And wonderful guy, absolutely superb.
10 planes claimed makes you a double ace.
Correct.
But you're over there flying for the Royal Air Force against these German fighters. I imagine you had more than your share of close calls.
Oh, my God, quite a bit, yeah.
What stands out in your mind? If people read your book, what are the ones they're going to say? Holy moly, is that the truth?
After 106 missions, I was on an escort mission down to Bordeaux, France, and we got into a fight there. I sat down three of the guys there, and, of course, on the way back, I lost my engine flying a P-51, and I crash-landed south of Le Havre, about 25, 30 kilometers. The Germans came after me. I was trying to put fire on my crashed Mustang, and they began to fire over my head, all over the place. And I got so scared, I dropped everything, and I ran, and I got into a forest. They came into the forest, and it was then how I more or less lost them. And for 5 days, I wandered all over the countryside with an injured shoulder, and then about 5 days later, I made contact with the resistance. Thank God I had learned French in high school in Athens, but I never really thought that I would speak French in America, you know, but it came handy, you know, at that time. And I'll never forget one of my Frenchman friends, you know, he told the other guy, he said, "Le Grec American parle français." You know, the Greek American speaks French. And they took care of me so wonderful. And I got decorated by Charles de Gaulle with 2 kisses when I was given the French Croix de Guerre. And about 3-4 years ago, I got a letter from the American Embassy in Washington. "Dear Colonel Pisanos, the government in Paris discovered that you contributed immensely for our liberation. And they have awarded you the Legion of Honor, the highest French decoration." They wanted to know whether I could go to Washington to be decorated. I told them that I couldn't make it. They came out here, and they presented me with the decoration at the museum in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And it was unbelievable. There were more people and friends and everybody.
I imagine you received some pretty heady decorations from our government as well.
Oh, yeah.
During
the
war.
I got 5 DFCs and the Legion of Merit with 2 clusters. And
5 Distinguished Flying Crosses, no big deal. You mentioned that incident. After 106 missions between flying the Spitfires with the RAF and flying American fighters, you're in a P-51, you're shot up, and you brought it in for a crash landing. Did you think about trying to bail out at any point?
Well, I tried to, but I was having difficulties when I decided not to bail out in high altitude because the Germans were really shooting at anybody coming down in a parachute. So I decided to wait until I get lower, but then as I tried to unstrap myself, you know, I was so goddamn close to the ground, and I had stepped out on the from the cockpit, and I was just ready to, you know, when the aircraft was to hit the ground, you know, try to. But thank God, the right wing hit the ground, the aircraft twisted to the right a little bit, and I was thrown way, just missing the prop, the stab prop, you know. And how long I stood right there, you know, lying on my back, and I looked up in the sky, and I said, "My God," I said, "my shoulder," and so on. And it was then when the Germans evidently had spotted me and followed the aircraft, you know, when I crash-landed.
So you weren't even at the controls when you crash-landed.
Oh, yeah.
You were standing.
I was standing outside the cockpit.
Trying to jump.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, my book has the photo on the outside of the book. Mm-hmm. Shows how I'm standing out by the cockpit, outside the cockpit.
Uh-huh. I've seen that photo, and I'll make sure it's on our website at hometownheroesradio.com. So you jump off, you're banged up, you're injured, but the Germans are still shooting at you.
And when I saw the bullets flying all over my head, you know, I decided to drop everything, forget about burning the aircraft, you know, and I began to run. And thank God I was close to the forest there, and that's when I got into the forest. And they came along too, and I lost them in the forest, of course. And for 5 days, I wandered all over the countryside, and I drank water from running creeks, and I found a farm, you know, that had cabbage. And my God, I ate a whole cabbage one day. I was so hungry and scared and injured and so on. And until later on, I made contact with the French.
Right, so this French resistance, the underground, gets you out of there, And then did you go back to flying?
No. When Paris was liberated and some 800 Americans came out from hiding, B-17 guys and fighter pilots, of course. We were all brought back to England, and I went back to my unit, but they wouldn't let me fly. So I was returned to the States, and I was assigned to Dayton, Ohio at Wright Field. Mm-hmm. That's when I went through test pilot school with Yeager and Don Gentile and all those guys. And I took a good part in testing the P-80, the first jet we had at Muroc Lake.
I think people are getting the idea from your cross-Atlantic journey that you're plotting and no one else knows about, that you're going to jump off in America, to going over to fly for the British, to all these missions for the British and the Americans, to then back as a test pilot. It doesn't seem like you're afraid of much.
No.
Where does that come from?
I don't know. I don't know. The Greek blood or something. something.
The flying Greek. You sure it wasn't the crazy Greek?
Oh, my God. No. Could have been, yeah.
You mentioned that P-80.
Yeah.
What was that like? Because, I mean, this is a complete experiment. Nobody knows if this is safe or not, and it's your job
absolutely.
To be the guinea pig.
Yeah,
huh?
I was one of the test pilots who did the test program at P-80. And funny, you know, later on when I met Adolf Galland and I told him I had flown the ME-262, the FW-190, the MU-109, he thought that I was a pilot, you know, belonging to one of the Balkan air forces.
Ah.
So then I had to tell him who I was and so on.
Ah. Because that was one of the other things you did at the tail end of World War II, was you flew captured enemy aircraft?
Correct.
To get a feel for their capabilities?
Yeah, to test it. Yeah, we had them at Wright Field.
Uh-huh.
I flew the FW-190, the MU-109, the Zero.
Uh-huh.
And the ME-262.
So this is after the war's over.
After the war, yeah.
But all these captured aircraft are there. So when you're flying one of these planes that had been flying against Americans during the war, what are you trying to do? What are you trying to learn?
We were trying to find out, you know, what the Germans had done that we did not know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's comparing their aircraft with our own aircraft.
So how would you compare the ME-262 to the P-51, which you flew? Because those two saw combat against each other.
Yeah. Well, the ME-262 was, the FW-190, they were really, the German aircraft were far superior than even the British, the Spitfire or the Hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, they were good flying machines.
Does that make it even more amazing to you?
Oh, absolutely.
That your side won?
Absolutely, yeah.
How do you explain all that? How do you explain your story?
Well, it's hard to tell, but... That's why I wrote the book. Yeah.
Did I see somewhere that Yeager was shot down the same day you were?
The 5th of March, 1944. We didn't know each other, you know, until we met later on, you know. He said, you went down the 5th of March? I went down too. And it was the same mission. Our group took the bombers down to Bordeaux, and his group brought the bombers back.
Uh-huh.
And that's when we, both of us, went down.
How about that? And years later, you're test pilots together.
Unbelievable, yeah.
And how long did you keep that up? How long did you continue flying for the Air Force?
I left in the latter part of 44, and I joined TWA.
All right.
I flew for TWA for about a couple more years, and then I was on a flight to Washington, D.C., and I met my buddy, Don Gentile, who was at the Pentagon. And I told him that, you know, I don't know whether the airline flying, you know, is really what I want. Well, he said, about coming back on active duty. I said, they won't take me. I don't have a two-year college. They want college guys. Yeah, but he said, the experience you have, you know, they will ought to have you. I'm going to send you an application for a return to active duty, he said. Oh, about less than a month, you know, a Western Union guy knocked my door. He said, Mr. Pisanos? I said, yeah. He said, you got a telegram. By direction of the President of the United States, you are recalled to active duty and you have to report to headquarters USAF. Yes.
So then you went back in. You rose to the rank of colonel?
Yes.
And when did you retire?
The end of 73.
So were you over flying in Vietnam?
Yes, I flew in Vietnam, and I was involved in Korea, but I didn't fly any missions in Korea. I was delivering fighter aircraft, Mustangs, from the Air National Guard to Korea.
And what did you do in Vietnam?
In Vietnam, I was a pilot with the Caribou Squadron, C-7, and although I had volunteered from Germany to go to Vietnam as a fighter pilot.
Mm.
But when they found out that I had in my records, you know, an airline transport pilot, and they decided to send me, you know, to a Caribou squadron. And that's where I ended up.
So you're flying cargo planes.
Yeah, I flew over 100 missions. in Vietnam.
Do you miss it?
A little bit, yeah. It was a lot of experience, yeah, unbelievable.
If you could tomorrow take any plane up in the sky, and you flew the best planes of every country involved in World War II, and you kept flying long after that, you've flown just about everything. If there's one aircraft you could take up tomorrow, what would it be?
The Mustang.
The P-51.
51, yeah.
Why?
Good aircraft. Well, it had the endurance, was equivalent in maneuvering, equivalent to the Spitfire. And all of us, you know, in the 4th Fighter Group, that we ended up with more victories than any other Air Force organization, felt that the 51 was really the greatest aircraft. Even Adolf Galland admired the 51.
Yeah, he didn't like going up against it, I know.
Yeah.
When you think about your own life experience, what's the most amazing part in your mind, the most amazing aspect of your story?
Becoming an American citizen. Honest to God, this wonderful country is the greatest in the world. And I get mad, especially some guys, you know, who one time on the television, he said, "God damn America." Mm. I told my wife, I said, "I'm going to go and meet this guy, you know, and kill that son of a buck, then check in with the FBI. Oh, he says, "Sit down. Don't be silly." But, you know, this country is the most wonderful country on earth. There is no question about that. And anyone who criticizes America or speaks bad about America, I get mad.
Have you ever wondered how different your life would have been if you didn't jump ship in Baltimore?
I would have probably ended up in Greece somewhere and becoming something.
And speaking of Greece, I've got to close that loop here. You said when you left Greece and you came to America, your family didn't hear from you till after World War II. So how did you re-engage with your family, and what was that like?
I finally got in contact with them, and of course they were surprised that I was still alive. But the funny part was that my last assignment in the Air Force, I got a call from the Pentagon. When I came back from Vietnam, I was assigned to Little Rock Air Force Base. I had been promoted to colonel. I got a call, "How would you like to go to Athens as chief of the Air Force mission?" I said, "Come on." I said, "Who are you pulling my leg?" No. He says, this Colonel Hank Stovall, he says, I told my guys to find me a colonel who can speak Greek and fighter pilot and so on. The reason is that the Greek Air Force was looking to buy a new fighter. And they looked at the French Mirage, the British Jaguar, and the American Phantom. And we need someone, you know, who can speak Greek to help us, you know, sell. And my God, that's exactly what happened. They sent me to Athens, you know, and I was the chief of the Air Force mission there. So we had a big competition. So I called a contact I had at the Pentagon. I said, "I want you to make arrangements and send me 2 Phantoms from Germany for a demonstration in Athens." And that convinced the Greeks, you know, to buy the A4.
Mm-hmm.
And they bought that in 1973-74, and my God, they're still flying it to this day.
Mm-hmm. Thanks to you. A gift to your homeland.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
Well, Steve, I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for sharing a little bit of your amazing story with us. Is there anything else you think we need to know?
No, I think America has been the greatest, and you better be good to my adopted country, because if you speak bad about my adopted country, I'll get mad.
The late, great Steve Pisanos. Again, his book is The Flying Greek. You can link to that at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, a veteran who, like Steve, had his plane shot down and whose perspective on America and freedom was forever shaped by the months he spent living in the absence of freedom as a prisoner of war. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. see for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our Independence Day special that I hope adds to your perspective on our country and the ideals of freedom and liberty that inspired its founding 247 years ago. The third and final World War II veteran whose memories we're hearing today is Carl Heuser, a native of Paso Robles, California, who served as a gunner in the three-man crew of an A-20 Havoc flying with the 410th Bomb Group, 644th Squadron. August 4th, 1944 was supposed to be a day off for Carl, but he volunteered to fly when another gunner reported sick.
There was nothing ahead of time to warn us. We knew that there was. We could see, and you'd fly right through them. The bursts of the black smoke, you'd fly right through it. But sooner or later, there would be one for you. And sure enough, it just picked us right out of the center of the squadron, just took the whole tail off of our airplane. And like I said, the gunner down with Fred, who was down below, he had his camera, and the camera was just blown out of his. But that's what kept him from getting killed. Otherwise, that blast would have killed him. His flak suit looked like somebody had taken a shotgun about 5 feet away and just shot at him. I was still in pretty good shape when I got there. I was not wounded, but like I said, I spent as little time as I could in the air. But the Germans were there waiting for me when I came down. They were right there on the ground. The same people that shot us down, by the way. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, they were pretty proud of us. They marched us into town. They let us keep our shoes on, but they took all the rest of our paraphernalia off, all the military stuff, and took that off.
So you and the gunner landed somewhere near the same spot?
He landed about 2 miles from where I did, because he was up higher. The wind blew him that way. But I landed. I came right down in the middle of where the anti-aircraft battery was, the camp. I was right close to that. I came right down there. But then they brought us together. And they marched. They didn't. The German officer that came had a motorcycle. We didn't see any trucks until later on after they captured us. This is kind of funny. They put us into the basement of a home and took all of our clothes off. Everybody took us stark naked, and then they marched us upstairs to stand in front of this officer's desk. He's going to interrogate us. And here I'm standing there stark naked, and this guy's playing with my .45, my gun. And I knew it was loaded. I had a shell in the chamber. And I'm telling him, you stupid so-and-so, that gun is loaded. You better let me take care of it. And the guards are poking me in the back with their rifles. The adrenaline was really flowing because I didn't have any fear at all about hurting him, but I had to tell him. So he finally handed me my .45 and let me take it apart. I took all the shells out of him and put it back on the desk. That was a funny thing.
What was going through your mind as you floated down to the ground, got captured, get taken to be interrogated, all that? I mean, I'm sure you never expected to be in that situation. So what was it like when you were? Were you just kind of shocked? What were you feeling?
You thought about what you did when certain things would happen. You always had to sort of presuppose things and so on. But I had never thought about what would happen if I got shot down. I was not going to get shot down. So there it comes, and I'm doing it. And I can only remember very vaguely the thoughts that went through my head. I said, damn it, the war's over for you. You're not going home after any 65 missions. Then, of course, I could also say that I was glad to be alive. I got a good story to tell you. In prison camp, in our camp, we were all in bed. There was a lot, just oodles of us. There were over 8,000 of us in Salaglator. And we'd go out to have a parade every day. Every morning I had a parade. As soon as we'd get up, they'd count us. The Germans could only count by fives, so we had to line up by fives. So they had given us a parcel when we got for it. A sweater in it and some shorts and socks and toothpaste and so on. And anyhow, I had a box of a can of brown shoe polish. I wonder why they wanted us to shoe polish. And now, we had a guy in our room. His name was Beatty. And Beatty came from Tonawanda, New York. And he was always telling stories. He was funnier than hell. Anyhow, he went around to everybody and convinced them all to paint a brown Hitler mustache with that shoe polish. And our whole barracks did that. Well, we fell out as usual. And the German guard did not know how to handle this. They run back and forth. Usually this would take about 5 or 10 minutes. It took us 20 minutes. They said, stay right here. So then they went to the commandant, our commandant came up. And he said, what's the matter? And he laughed. And, you know, they said, go back to your barracks. So the German guards then went to the barracks, and they convinced the commandant the German commandant. We had heard good feelings about him. He had been an ME-109 pilot shot down in Africa and been sent to America for medical treatment, and he was back again. He was a tall guy, very imposing. I mean, he was a real typical, if you want to say a typical German officer, this was him. So he came in, and here we're lined up again, all with our mustaches. And I still think I saw a smile on his face. But he's told to, but anyhow, they chatted for about 5 or 10 minutes. Okay, everybody back there, but no more facial paintings, no more face paintings. Okay, so we won't paint any more Hitler mustaches on. That was funny. We had to make our own fun.
Well, yeah, you had to make your own a lot of things, from what I understand from all the POWs I've interviewed. How difficult was it to be in those conditions, whether it was the weather, the lack of proper food, the uncertainty of the whole thing, not knowing when you're ever going to get out of there? How did you deal with all of that?
Everybody had their own feelings about what was going to happen to them. We didn't have any idea how the Germans were going to treat us or mistreat us. We were all apprehensive. We thought, well, you know, they could mistreat us, but they did not mistreat us. The only thing they didn't do, they didn't feed us, but they did not mistreat us.
No, and you were there for a while, all the way until February 1945, when they marched you out of there to avoid the incoming Russians.
We were the last people to get out, I think, really. And it was snow. It was one of the worst winters they'd had back there. And we took our blankets, so that's all we had. Sleep three together. And I had had a blood poisoning on my foot. I stepped on a piece of glass, and I got an infection in my foot. And that foot was still... It was healing because the doctor had healed it up, but it was still warm from fever. And everybody that put their feet, all their feet against my one foot to keep their feet warm when we sleep. We slept on the snow many times at night, and you did a lot of rolling around. You didn't sleep an awful lot, but then the next morning you get up and you know, get going again. The Germans had dogs that they had with them pretty quick. Their dogs were all of our good friends. We could pet them and stuff. That march, almost 3 months, 88 days we marched. We would go from town to town. Some days we'd march 30 kilometers. Some days we'd march 5 kilometers. They just did not know what to do with us except to keep us away from the Russians. That was their main, because they were scared stiff of the Russians for good reason. Because the Russians were entirely different kind of soldiers than the Germans were. As I said, the Germans did not abuse us. They just didn't feed us.
Let's expound on that for a minute if you can, because some people who've heard this show and heard other POWs might have an idea of what that was like. But let me just ask you a few questions. How much do you think you weighed when you were captured?
Less than 100 pounds. I must have weighed maybe close to, I had my regular weight at that time about 145 pounds. And probably weighed about 90 pounds when I was liberated. We lost a lot of weight.
Well, and for you, a lot of that was due to the march, too. But just in the camp itself, I'm sure you started losing weight. What all did they feed you? Are we talking about the infamous bread you need a power saw to cut through, or what were you eating?
The German rations in camp was a bucket full of potatoes per room, and they had to be scraped, not peeled. They had to be scraped, and then they would go back and cook them, and then get them back in for lunch. And a bucket full of potatoes and a piece of, like pumpernickel bread, about maybe an inch and a quarter thick, and a pat of butter on top of that. And that was the German ration. That's what the Germans gave us. We had Red Cross parcels, and they would dole them out to us as they wanted to. But that was what I saved it, because we would get, every day we get a different can. You had to turn in, if you turned in 20 cans, if you got 20 cans, you had to turn in 20 cans, so you couldn't keep any cans. So, but every day was a little bit something different. Red Cross parcels were very, very helpful. That's why some people don't like the Red Cross too much, but they were the people that got that stuff to us. So, I remember I wrote a letter to Ann Landers, because she had taken on the Red Cross for some reason. I said, don't forget what they did for us. They were the ones that got it to us. That was important.
I've heard some stories over the years, different things that guys did with some of those cans or materials they'd get from the Red Cross, some pretty improvisational ways that they used different materials, whatever they could get their hands on. Do you think back on anything you saw in your camp, whether you made or someone else made, that you never would have thought of that?
After the camp froze over, this is December now, and the big parade ground is all frozen over, the Germans had poured water on it. Some of the guys would take the skin from a Klim can and trying to make skis, trying to put skates on their shoes, and they were falling and tumbling around out there. It was kind of funny to watch, because nobody was going to make a pair of skates out of a tin can, but they tried. I'm sure the Germans were eating very well too, because they were eating our parcels also, and they had thousands of them. They had tons of them.
Did you hear from home at all? Did they hear from you at all?
We were given two letters and four postcards every month to write. I never got anything from them. I think very few of the guys in our camp got any mail back. That was hard. Now, remember, it was August the 4th when I was shot down. Excuse me. My parents probably had a letter or two after that, but they did not know what happened to me until January. I was there. I wasn't even thinking about that. But when I got home, I thought, boy, that was a long time not to know anything. I've still got the cables from the government.
And I want to understand what life was like in that camp. And like you said, everyone had a little different perspective there. But when you look back at the time you spent in captivity, do you see something that helped you get through that? Was there something about your mindset, your faith, your confidence? How did you survive all that in the face of so many things that would make people want to give up?
We supported each other. I think that's the prime feature of this. When we saw a guy starting to get a little bit, you know, he's on his way, we would gather up together and take care of him. We'd walk with him. We would give him extra, some of our food, if necessary. But anyhow, we were going to make damn sure that nobody in our care went off the deep end. And I think we all knew that we were going to win the war. We knew we were going to, it doesn't matter when. We all knew that we just had to do what we had to do to stay alive, to stay there. Like I said, it was just making sure that nothing happened to me, because nothing's going to happen to you.
How did you guys, inside your camp, keep up with what was going on outside your camp? Did you have any idea of how close the end of the war was getting?
We had a logger. There were four loggers. The first logger was made up with mostly the British troops, and the British had a radio. They would call it the Gash. Every day, somebody from the British compound would go up to on sick call, and then he would spread the gash to the guys. The German guard, there were not enough of them to take care of us, so we had plenty of room there. And only, you see, the doctors were our American surgeons, American flight surgeons. They would tell the guy, and then this guy would come back to his logger and go from barracks to barracks and tell them what yesterday's news was. And so we knew the pretty what was going on in the war, because we had the British had, they had bamboozled a German guard to bring him the pieces they had to. If you'd ask a German guard for a match and he gave you a match, you had something on him. He was not supposed to give you that match. So you had something on him, and you said, I'm going to tell. And so they were very careful. But it was funny in that way. You could bribe them with food or cigarettes. They liked our cigarettes, but they had more of our cigarettes than we did.
And you already referenced the march, the infamous march, the march that claimed a lot of lives, thankfully not yours. How did that come about? I'm sure you weren't expected to be taken out of your barracks and marched halfway across the continent.
As I said, our camp was up in Poland, and the Russians were coming close. The Russians were coming from the east towards the west, and the Germans had no use at all for the Russians. They were scared stiff of the Russians. And so they, as I said, they marched us out 1,000 a day, and We were one of the last groups that went out there, but they gave us a parcel of food to take with us, and we had our blankets and so forth, and we just had to go as we went. And like I said, it was the first part of February, and this is one of the worst winters that they had had in Northern Europe, and it was a bitter, bitter winter, bitter cold. And three of us would gather together, and we would just hug each other to try to stay warm at night. As we went on and the weather got better, then we began to read each other's shirt sleeves and so forth for lice. We had lice. And we had the same clothes on for 3 months. We didn't change anything. A lot of us had dysentery, and our pants were dirty, and we couldn't do a thing about it. We just had to keep on going. And we had GI shoes, and that's one thing that I had. I traded my GI shoes with a Moroccan kid. He was in the next compound, and we talked to him, and he said he would give me a can of Spam to trade my shoes. He had British shoes. So he threw his shoe over one, I threw my shoe over, and he threw me a can of Spam over and threw another shoe. So I had a can of Spam and his shoes. His shoes had hobnails in the heels. They were well made. They were British. They were well made. But, oh, talking about miserable hawk talking with, instead of rubber, hobnails on your heels. So I had to wear those for the last month or so that I had. My feet were pretty well tired.
And on that march, and I don't know if people can really fathom marching for that long and for that many miles, I'm sure there were guys that were getting weak and couldn't keep up. What happened to someone who just couldn't keep going?
Occasionally, and this only happened, I would say, 12, 15 times, if a guy had to fall out of the formation, a guard had to go with him. And very often, you'd hear a one shot and the guard would come back alone. But because the guy he couldn't make it anymore, the guard knew it, he knew it, and they'd just leave him there. They would. When we get to a little town, if they had some people that were sick, We talk to the German guards and tell them, and they would try to make arrangements there to have someone look after you in the little town. So several of our guys bailed out that way. They stayed in the little town where the Germans were taking medical care of them. And the Americans told us, your duty is to escape. And we said, you tell me my duty is to escape. I can see myself a solid citizen walking down the street in a uniform, a German, U.S. uniform, walking down a German street. No way. You're going to get shot and killed immediately. So we knew it was our duty to escape, but nobody was going to try to escape. That would have been foolish. It would have been foolish. And we admitted that.
You talked about people that couldn't keep going and what the German guards would do, and then others would get medical attention and so forth. Were there ever moments where you wondered if you could keep going, where you thought you were about at your last ounce of strength?
No. And the reason is my faith in God. I prayed. In fact, I was the leader of our little group, and I would pray. When we'd get started, we'd always have a prayer, and we'd wind up with the Lord's Prayer. And I never did even think that I wasn't going to make it because of my faith in God. And I knew He was going to take care of me.
Well, and obviously He did, and I think everyone listening appreciates how powerful that reality is for you, especially looking back now. I don't want to dwell on this too long, but just so we understand how brutal this march was.
The cold, for one thing. You told me that you would come to a farmhouse and see a big old pile of manure, stinky manure, and stick your feet in the pile of manure because you knew it was warm?
And we could also do the same thing with food. Put it in there to get it warm if we had it, and you pull it out and you'd eat it. I mean, it didn't matter that it had been in a pile of manure. It was something to eat, and food was so, there was nothing, absolutely nothing thrown away. It was just, you'd eat everything you could and then some. Whenever we get to, when we were brought down into smaller groups, and towards the end of the war, maybe 200 or 250 of us, the Germans would put us into a barn, and we would sneak out, and we'd raise a big huckus over here, so all the guards had to go over there, and then these guys would go out and find a couple of chickens and kill the chickens, and we'd build a little fire in the barn, build a little fire and cook the chickens. And you know, it was very ingenious the way they made do like that if they could. If you could find a chicken, then there was got to be eggs, so you look for the eggs. I remember I got shot at. I was the farmers had a basement where they kept their beets and their other things underground. And I had made a dash out there, and I was coming back, and I had my arm full of beets, sugar beets. I got shot at. And I remember, I could hear the bullet.
Could you tell when you were getting toward the end of that march, did you sense freedom beckoning? What do you remember about those last moments of the march and how great it felt to be free again?
The guards were getting closer and closer to us. They were telling us their names, and they knew they were going to be prisoners also. So they were telling us their names, and they said, in a way, you know, please take care of me. The only guard we had one guy named Big Snoop. He had to be 7 feet tall, and he'd just pick you up by your hair and pick you up. He was mean. He got chopped up with axes, and he was chopped up pretty bad before they got there. But when we turned the Germans over to the Americans, we just marched them into an area. They threw their guns on a pile and marched them into an area and marched us around them, and that was the end of it. And then we went to a bridge. This is at Elberfeld. Went to a bridge, and half of the bridge had been bombed. We were on pylons. An American Jeep. A soldier in a Jeep. And he's handing us cigarettes. And we cried. That was the moment of freedom. And we just stood there and cried. Grown men. I'll never forget that.
How could you forget that? Carl Heuser never did, nor should we forget the emotions his story and those from Sam Tarasaki and Steve Pisano stirred in us today. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I hope that you and your family have a wonderful Independence Day. So many have fought and died for the principles and ideals articulated in that declaration 247 years ago, but it's up to us to live in such a way that assigns a value to our freedom that might someday measure up to the price that's been paid. A simpler way of remembering that principle comes in those four words we close the program with each and every week. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.